I'm going to be talking about kind of the process of archiving digital works. I'm Howard Besser from NYU's Tisch School of the Arts and director of a moving image archiving and preservation program, which you can tell because it's up there. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the problem is. Marjorie already illustrated some examples of that, but I'm going to go into much more extensive discussion of that, a little bit on approaches to solutions and what we can try to do, and a little bit about access. So if you're thinking of preserving any type of digital work, for the next 15 minutes or so, I'm going to be talking about what the issues are in that. I'll talk mainly about the problem, a little bit about preservation repositories and preservation metadata, a little bit about some other activities, but and then kind of focus in on some paradigm shifts. We have serious problems with longevity, with any type of digital works. How many of you were using a word processor 15 years ago? And 15 years ago, what were you using as a word processing application program? Probably WordStar. Okay. WordStar had the largest installed base at that time. There were millions and millions of WordStar files created. Can any of you read those WordStar files? You better not call attention to yourself, or you may have everybody here with great difficulty. And typically, with things like, even with Microsoft Word, you can only read back two versions of Word. So you can, with Windows Millennium, you can read Windows 98 for Word for Windows 98, but you can't read back any further. And when you get third-party kind of applications to read back further, you start losing things like tables, forget it, even boldface, centering, things like that. And these are all word processing things. They're simple, they're based on text, they don't have interactivity, color, complexity to them. And we can't even, this is 15 years later, we have a great deal of difficulty even reading them. So we've got a problem, but the problem is much bigger than the problem for electronic literature environment. Previous formats, you know, before we had digital formats, before we had any type of electronic formats, are the kinds of things that people created, books, for instance, cuneiform tablets, papyrus scrolls, those types of formats required little ongoing intervention. You put things in a remote storage facility, and then you went back, you know, 100 years later and got them, things like that. Digital, you can't do that with. It requires intense ongoing management. So let me talk a little bit about the digital problem, and I've written about this. I'll give you some URLs for some of the things that I've written, which I have purposely tried to make available, and though, of course, they're copyrighted because I can't avoid that. These are things that I call the viewing problem, the scrambling problem, the interrelation problem, the custodial problem, and the translation problem. So first, the viewing problem is that digital information requires a whole infrastructure to view it. As I said before, those kind of cuneiform tablets and papyrus scrolls, their default is to persist over time. If you don't do anything like cause a fire or rip them up or somehow destroy them, their default is to persist over time. And even if we can't understand their language, we can at least read it. We may need a Rosetta Stone to translate what it is that's there, but we can read the letters, we can read the script, we can tell what is there. Even with film, we can hold it up to the light, even if we don't have the right projector, we can still hold it up to the light and see what's on it. Problem with digital information is that it's usually encoded and requires application software which runs on a particular operating system which needs a particular hardware platform. It's usually stored on a physical device which requires a particular type of device driver connected to a particular type of computer. And if all of that isn't bad enough, every piece of that is changing at a rapid rate. So we have the file formats from WordStar to Word 1 to Word 3 to Word for Windows 95. We have the storage devices. Do people remember 8-inch floppy disks? 5 1/4-inch floppy disks? Who is it? I think Dell announced about a month ago that they're not even making 3-inch floppies anymore. And CD-ROMs, DVDs, and whatever comes after. Our operating systems have gone from, I started out with CPM, MS-DOS, Windows, or the various Apple versions. So how can we hope to deal with all the kind of permutations and combinations of these things? So that's the viewing problem. Second part is what I call the scrambling problem. And this is that to solve short-term problems, we engage in practices that can result in long-term peril. So for instance, because as Marjorie talked about a little bit, and we've heard a little bit this morning, people tried to configure things for low bandwidth situations, for low storage situations, when that was a problem. And we can see how that causes problems with us playing them back now. We do things like compress files to ease storage and delivery. But the act of compression adds one more level of complexity that we have to worry about decompressing these things 50 years from now when we're not even going to know how to do that. For digital commerce, we have encryption schemes, including some, you know, horrible things that you could never think would last over time, where you need like various different servers acting, and one of them takes your credit card and then gives a key back to decrypt the file, and like all of these things are going to be working, 10 years from now, let alone 50 or 100 years from now, in the same way to unlock and decrypt those files. So we've done these kinds of things that add to the complexity and add to the problems of trying to be able to see a work in the future, a work that's created today. Next is what I call the interrelation problem. Our information is increasingly interrelated to other information, and there's a big question, even if we want to make the things we create persist, it's really difficult to try to do that. What's the most common web page one finds? 404 file not found? Now, do you think that you're finding those 404 file not found because someone purposely withdrew something and didn't want you to see it? It's just part of ordinary management that you shift files around or that you rename a folder or directory or you rename a server or someone else renames your server, and then everything that points to it doesn't work. Typically, I come and I will show one of my websites in a room that doesn't have an internet connection. There is a real question as to what I put on a CD or a disk drive and bring into that room, because what is the boundary of the work? My website. What's the boundary of my website? Because my things like my homepage points to work that my students did, which is on a different server. It also points to work that I've done that's part of committee work that's still on a different server. And all of these things point to each other. Where is the boundary of my website? We don't even have the words to talk about these things and to kind of circumscribe what it is we're trying to save. So that's another part of this interrelation problem, which is really a part of hypermedia. Next is what I call the custodial problem. And in the past, most of what we have that has persisted over time has persisted because of redundancy. It's that there were, 500 copies of the Gutenberg Bible, and they were in various different places, and some of them got destroyed, some of them were burned, and some of them had, were in buildings that collapsed, and, some of them probably got used for kindling. But because of the redundancy factor, things survive. In a digital world, there's a real tension. One of the things we say is that we only want one copy. We don't want a bunch of proliferating copies because it's inefficient, and because if we make changes, we don't want to deal with having to make changes in lots of different places at the same time. So that's an issue. How do we decide what to save and who should save it? And there's an incredible number of questions about that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that this afternoon in Jeff's session. More and more of what used to be discoverable in our in collections of personal papers and archives is now created online. If you think about the history of literature, of science, you have various versions of manuscripts, and you can see the first and the second and the third, various versions of Huck Finn, for instance. You have correspondence between Mark Twain and various other people. The Mark Twain of today, who's writing, is probably not systematically saving every version, or even any versions, as they edit their manuscript. They're probably just editing it online. The kind of correspondence that they might engage in with other people commenting on it is probably email. And who's saving this? Is anyone saving this? If the author themselves wants to save it, how are they going to do it? There's not even any guidelines for doing that. So when we're talking about trying to save these things, there are we're trying to make things persist over time. There's some concepts that that those of us who deal with preservation repositories use. In terms of methods for later access, there's the concept of refreshing. This is the idea that that 8-inch floppy disk that you had 15 or 20 years ago will not be playable in 5 or 10 years because the physical medium that it's on may not last. Even if the physical medium lasts, you won't have a player and a driver to make it work. So even if the disk itself would last, you won't have a disk drive that that you can put it into that will work with a more modern computer. So the idea of refreshing is that you move the same file, say a WordStar file, from one physical storage to another every 5 or 10 years to keep it available to make sure that you can read it. Refreshing is done usually in conjunction with either the concept of migration or the concept of emulation. The concept of migration is that you take that WordStar file and move it into Word 1, and then move it into into Word 3 and move it into Word for Windows 95, for Windows 98, for Millennium Windows. You periodically move it to a different different type of file format. That's the general concept of migration. The concept of emulation is you keep it in that WordStar format and you write viewers or readers or emulators that will let you read it on later types of architecture. Now, there's real problems with from an archival standpoint with any of these things. You have in the archival world, we have things called issues of authenticity and evidence. As you're changing making those changes, how do you know that you didn't introduce something that made it not work as well? So you know, if you were taking for instance one of the works like My Boyfriend Came Back from the War, and moving it from place to place, from format to format with a migration, how do you know that you lost the sound? Unless you're looking at every single work and you have someone who knows that work looking at it. Someone who's an archivist who's looking at it, as Marjorie pointed out, wouldn't necessarily know that the sound was there in the first place. So there's clear issues about something being authentic, and then the various ways in which it's been put up, as she showed, really each of those looks a little bit different. There's also really terrible copyright problems involved in trying to make these things persist over time. For instance, if you are trying to make a viewer for an old application, Story Space 1, or a viewer for Microsoft Word 1, you have to essentially reverse engineer that application in order to make that software. And reverse engineering used to be legal. It used to be an important concept, but the Digital Millennium Copyright Act made this illegal, and we have just absurd cases like a recent case on Lexmark, the printer, that a company that was making new printer cartridges was found to be in violation of their copyright over, is it copyright or trademark? Their copyright over the way in which they the kind of intelligence within the chip within the printer cartridge. So I mean, there's really horrible kind of copyright issues involved in trying to maintain a repository of these types of works. Not to mention issues when you get to access the fact that some of these works may have used some background music, or may have some kind of underlying rights that may have been appropriate and may have been licensed for a particular type of use in the way it was distributed, but they're not licensed for use in for later use in a repository kind of situation. So I mean, this is just mind-boggling if you get into it. And the last problem I want to talk about is the translation problem, and that's that content translated into a new delivery device changes its meaning. I mean, we know that a photograph of a painting is not the same as a painting, but people get quite confused. I have people say, I went to see Apocalypse Now. I watched Apocalypse Now last night. I go, oh, where's it playing? Oh, I rented it. You know, that's not the film, it's the video. And it's not the same experience. And in the same way, we have a lot of works that have been created, that were created 5 years ago or 8 years ago, to be played on a VGA screen where they take up the entire screen. That's what they're supposed to do. Many of these have high-resolution images on them, or they are a high-resolution image. On today's screens, megapixel screens, those things take up about a third of the screen instead of the full screen. And so when you're trying to play them back on today's screens, you either have to do pixel replication to get the effect of the full screen, in which case they're very grainy, or they play in just a quadrant of the screen and you don't have the original effect. So there's some serious issues as we move into different different types of technologies, there's not simple answers in how to deal with these. So let me now shift and talk about some suggested approaches to solutions. The kind of approaches that people have offered for things like electronic literature are to save the hardware and software, to emulate, and to migrate. And there's problems with each of these, so don't think that I'm going to give you simple answers here. Saving the hardware and software is really a huge undertaking. Let me show you just some examples of other areas. I run a moving image archiving and preservation program, and we deal with things like video. For any of you who may have been around long enough, in the lower part of this is a quarter inch half inch reel to reel tape that was the first kind of consumer video video art used for video art in port-a-packs. We have in the top the kind that was used for distribution in educational environments, 3/4 inch U-matic. None of these can really it's hard to find a player for these anymore. The lower on the left hand side you have Beta. People remember Beta. These are outdated formats that it is very difficult to keep up and be able to show these. Here are some old digital formats. Bernoulli. Anyone remember the Bernoulli discs or SciQuest? In the back we have some computer tapes. If we go back to here, here's with video. We have the 1-inch videotapes, and there's also 2-inch videotapes. With 2-inch video, there is only one man left in the United States who can repair the equipment for 2-inch videos, and he's about to retire. I've been working with public television on some of the issues of this. So there's only, I think, 5 2-inch players that anyone knows about. And this is what broadcast television used for many, many years. So, and then with digital, we have, all kinds of problems. There's DAT tapes there. And all of these things are going away. And the idea of saving these, I think, is an impossible situation. It's too huge of an undertaking. And let me just give you a couple of examples of this. The Computer Museum tried to do that, and they pretty much failed and pretty much went out of business. The Computer Museum in Boston. And even when they were trying to do that, I'll give you a couple stories from a conference that Stuart Brand helped convene. There were about a dozen of us at the Getty in 98, I believe, called Time and Bits. And some of the stories that came out of that. Well, story one, Jaron Lanier had been asked to resurrect one of his early video games by the Computer Museum. He had kept the little cartridge for the game that he had created, and it ran on a TRS-80. And the Computer Museum had managed to resurrect a TRS-80, kept it running, brought it out. But the joystick that they had was from the model after the joystick that he had programmed the game for, and it wouldn't work. And they couldn't find the joystick from the earlier version where it would work, and they pretty much gave it up. There's a lot more to that story, but I'll save that for later. A second example. One of the participants in this Time and Bits event was Doug Carlson from president of Broaderbound Software, and he has a house in Aspen or Vail, somewhere like that, and he has like something like 8 workstations for all of different makes and models and different versions or different time periods, so that he can play his software. And he has a second exact duplicate of the workstation underneath, on a shelf underneath that. Well, he like started getting to the point where he was using the parts from the second one and the first one, and then he couldn't sustain this. So, and you know, this is the president of what was one of the largest software, certainly consumer software companies. They just couldn't sustain it. So, this kind of endless need for reformatting, and how you aren't going to have the physical devices for storing these things. It means that you have the possibility of loss in various generations, and it implies that you really need this kind of managed environment. So I would say that because of all these things, saving the software and hardware is really not a viable solution. And the only ones we have are emulation and migration. Again, migration is this idea of word star to word one to word three. Tables and complex figures often get corrupted. You need to repeat this every 4 to 5 years, and maybe even forever. Those are the negatives. The positive things are that we do know how to do this ourselves. We don't have to rely on other communities or highly trained specialists in order to do it. And if there's a problem, we can catch it soon. But I'm still very worried about how migration affects things like sound, as we saw with my boyfriend came back from the war, how it affects things like branching, navigation, interactivity, you know, the kinds of things that you would find in an authoring system like StorySpace. Emulation is the idea to keep that WordStar file as a WordStar file format, but you have to write emulators or viewers to see it in later environments. The positive thing is that there's a better chance of carrying over complexity, and many more features can survive, but perhaps not all the features, because whenever you write an emulator, you are making decisions about which features you want to carry forward. Or you write a viewer, you're making decisions about that. So now let me come back to this Jaron Lanier story. He couldn't get his exhibit up for the Computer Museum, and a number of years went by, and he got email from this group of kids who had resurrected his game, and who had written an emulator and were playing it. And he went to visit, and he looked at them playing the game, and he said, "That's not my game. The pacing is all wrong." The emulator had emulated most of the features, but it ran so much faster that he denied that it was his work because it was running so fast. So there's so many things that so many types of features that we may not think of as we build emulators. So let alone the intellectual property. Oh, I said that's the wrong word. The copyright issues for dealing with that are really problems. But still, you have much better hope of features surviving. Certain problems with emulation, if you have a problem, you may not find it for 40 or 50 years because you're not really looking at these files. So that's a downside. You need specialists and a whole infrastructure of emulators. And as I said before, there's serious copyright problems with the reverse engineering for this. So in any case, whatever we do, the really critical thing is that we need a paradigm shift from managing artifacts, managing actual physical things, which is what the approach of keeping the old hardware and software would be, to managing disembodied information over time. And we're starting to develop, the library world particularly is starting to develop this notion of preservation repositories. And I'll talk a little bit about that, those this afternoon. Merrily Prophet will also talk about those. And the key thing of these preservation repositories is to manage these works over long periods of time, to engage in things like a periodic refreshing and either emulation or migration. And here's just a drawing of a concept where with a preservation repository, according to this OAIS model, you have a negotiation about how it gets in and negotiation about how it comes out. Goes in on the left, comes out on the right, and that's part of an agreement between the creator or the holder of it and the repository itself, which includes how it will look out there to the user. And then you have the management of it internally, which is much more the responsibility of the repository itself. So the creator doesn't necessarily have to get involved in that. We really, in order to hedge our bets with digital preservation, I don't think, even if we do emulation, I don't think we can emulate every file format. I'm on this National Research Council group that's examining the National Archives digital preservation plan, and they did want to emulate, or did want to be able to reproduce every type of file format that anything comes into the National Archive on. And I just don't think that that's viable. But in any case, whether one follows migration or emulation, I think it's very important to save the bits in their original bit order, which would allow us, even if you're doing migration, would allow you to perhaps eventually do emulation later on or go back and check things if we develop some kind of skills that we haven't yet imagined on how to deal with this. But in any case, how you look at this stuff, maybe we should start looking at this as in a risk management situation. This is from the repository standpoint, that they can't definitively say that they can make every digital work persist. But what they can say is that the more that a digital work conforms to certain types of standards, metadata, best practices, the greater the likelihood that it will persist. You can put things in the repository that don't conform to those, but the repository is not likely to be able to say that they'll be able to resurrect it. They'll still take it and they'll try to deal with it, but this is the idea of risk management, and that persistence is most likely for works that share standards, metadata, and best practices. Saving metadata is really critical. That includes metadata about the software needed to view the work, about how the various pieces of the work fit together. And if we start developing encoding languages that separate behaviors and actions from how they're instantiated in particular environments, that is a better hedge on how we can save these things. And I'll hopefully talk about that a little bit more a little bit later. And these preservation repositories are really too complex. They're hugely complex to run. ELO cannot run this itself. ELO needs to partner with something like a digital library to actually run and manage these things. So that's it for my first part of my talk.
Back in just a little bit.
No.
When I looked at the opening screen that I had made, I had this sense of real satisfaction, and then it hit me that what I liked about it was it looked just like the television screen that I'd been watching for the Iraqi war with all these little things running along it. And I had been trained by that new media design with a bar across the middle almost two-thirds, you know, four-fifths of the way down, little bitsy's going by. I had been seduced into thinking that was a good-looking design, and so reproduced it for you all, and you will forgive me, I'm sure.
Because it was amazing. No, I didn't look at this.
It looks just like this. So here we are from Baghdad. Well, maybe it's Baghdad and Santa Barbara. Okay, because I really wanted to make sure that we would have plenty of concrete detail and fabric here. I'm going to just quickly, before Alan Divac starts talking, have us look at a few more works, because everything that Howard mentioned about the complexity of the archiving process itself and the technology is actually complicated as soon as e-literature moves on the web by a whole very set of publishing strategies. Writers moving their work onto the web from some other medium, arranging with different kinds of consortia for publishing, some of them just putting things up on their own sites, some of them repurposing other work. And Howard had said, well, you know, you're going to need to have this archive material, and we will. Looking again at the how very simple the early stuff was. Annie Abrahams was one of the early works that was an enormous success, her being human. And we look at it now and think, oh, you know, that's only like 6 years ago that it was. It's a beautiful little literary piece, but it was a technical innovation to have different typefaced words scattered on the page in different colored letters, you know. I remember when I first saw this and I thought, oh, now that is cool. And of course, Adrian Wurzel's The Electronic Chronicles, which still goes on. This is from Rob's portal. This is, now look at the strategies. Nick Montford's Winchester's Nightmare is now on the web, but it was originally a book that he sold with its own little computer. The cutest thing you ever did see, the most seductive thing I've ever seen in my life, a computer that belonged to its own novel. Now, of course, the idea of how it would be that we would recreate both the historical descriptive archive, the artifactual archive, and still preserve a web version of this. begins to kind of show the underside of that challenge. This is the unknown, of course, and now Scott and William and Dirk, the authors of The Unknown, published it on the web. They now have a Spineless Books print version, right, Scott?
Well, it's an anthology.
It's a what?
It's an anthology.
It's an anthology. And that particular, the unknown in my mind doesn't actually really exist unless the three authors are standing up reading it, because the sense of recreating the experience, if we're talking about that kind of authenticity, the unknown was primarily people were primarily exposed to it by going to see it be read. This particular piece by Peter Howard, again, a very short little flash piece, early flash, it brings up another serious problem for us, because Flash is, of course, a proprietary software owned by Macromedia. They themselves support Flash 1, Flash 2, Flash 3, Flash 4, Flash 5, Flash MX. However, Director 8 won't import Flash MX, and Director MX won't import Flash 5. So, you know, you've got two of the same softwares with the same company that in fact got their signals mixed about which one they were going to be backward compatible with. So this is an early flash, and we don't know when we begin to specify what we're going to have to do about those things. This is Rob Kendall's Clues, another piece that shows, since it's written, the sound is in Flash so that it will work on the web, and it's written in HTML, and it has been in a couple different versions, and Rob also originally had it as just a long poem, and he also had composed the music himself for it, so we have all this complexity in these very fragile pieces on the web. Christy Sheffield Sanford's work. This is Light Water. All of this done in DHTML, JavaScript, and much of it not playable now. I'm using Rainer Strasser's work here, The Dorman Passing. This one is done in video. And it's a very unusual piece, but again, it begins to show the complexity, even on the fragile web, of the formats that can be incorporated into web pages. Now, I think that it's key to notice that when ELO becomes an organization, and at the Brown Platforms for the 21st Century, Jeff and Scott and Rob Coover get together, and some other people start contributing ideas that are in the field all that year. 1999, the year that ELO was formed, was a year that was nearly a flat year for all electronic writers. There was, with the exception of Eastgate, no place to publish when we were at Cyber Mountain in June of 1999, because we spent the time, we weren't talking to Scott about what kind of an ELO thing we could do, we spent the rest of the time talking about the fact that there was no place to publish, because with the exception of the Iowa Review, Tom Swiss is here, which had just come out with Dina Larson's Ferris Wheels, and a couple, three other online places, none of the magazines that became available within the next 12 months were available in June of 1999. Eastgate was the sole publisher of In Hand Media, and most people were afraid to send anything to Eastgate that wasn't substantial, because if you were going to publish something that was going to be in a hard medium and have a cover and everything, you didn't send them a short little one poem. You needed to have something substantial. So ELO comes into being as a consequence of this, the whole instability of this field that is already beginning to show itself by 1999. And I think that most of the people that I see here and know well are very aware of certain kinds of areas of this, and I'm sure we're all interested in seeing, okay, can we establish the relationships that need to be established between these competing and very complex bridges that are almost, I'm sorry, I'm going back to the Gulf War. I'm thinking about crossing the Euphrates. I'm going to turn this over to Alan. He wants to do that? Okay.
Yeah. Alan wanted me to go ahead of him. Okay, so for the next 5 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about future directions for PAD. Talk about new ways of thinking about works and different versions of works. I'll look a little bit closer at standards, talk about some possible projects, and talk about developing relationships with other initiatives or collaborations. First, in terms of, there's a problem that I didn't really talk about earlier, which is the variant form problem. That there can, for any of these works, you may release it and you may change some things, release it again. There may be, you may decide to design it a little bit differently. There's this serious variant form kind of issue. And you certainly see a little bit of this in My Boyfriend Came Back from the War, in that different people have kind of used it in different ways or have done these different kind of variant forms. So one kind of way that the library community has started thinking about these variant forms is this thing called Functional Requirements for Bibliographic Records, FERBR, which is really to divide up what is the work itself from what is an expression of that work, to make a distinction between the work that you save and you may render in different environments, on different screens in different ways, at different points in time in different ways, that the work itself is separate from how it's expressed, and that within expressing it, there are also different manifestations of that. And to kind of start to divide this up is conceptually, I think, important in trying to save things both that have variant forms or that may be shown in different environments in the future, in kind of computer screens that we don't have now, in environments where the interaction with the user is very different. I mean, you think about it, we're all used to pointing and clicking with a mouse. But if you go back 15 years, 20 years, we were not pointing and clicking with a mouse. You were using arrow keys to choose things, arrow keys and a carriage return. Do you really think that 20 years from now, we're going to have mice that we're going to point and click? We'll be, you know, like looking with our head or pointing with our fingers or something. You know, there will be a different interaction. And so this separation separating out the work from the expression of the work helps you move those works into different environments because they aren't so dependent on what the actual interaction is and can be more extrapolated into a type of interaction than a physical pointing kind of thing. There are standards that are underway to handle and put together different pieces of complex works. These include an initiative called SMILE, Structural Metadata, something language. Synchronized multimedia. What?
Integration
language. Thank you. This is an attempt to take the different kind of pieces, you know, sound, particular images, different pieces of text, and to be able to express in a standard way how they fit together, how they're timed one after the other, so you have a time element to them as well. So moving into those types of environments rather than in a proprietary system like StorySpace or like Director or something like that, to be able to either within that software export it into one of these structured languages or to be able to actually keep it in one of those structured languages, we stand a better chance of trying to make those things work many years in the future. And there's a number of these things, but most of them don't actually have the aspect of interactivity or don't handle that very well. So one of the things I'm going to suggest is that we work with extending some of these structured languages in different ways. So let me just lay out two kind of rough scenarios for how we might proceed. One of these is how we handle past works, and the other is how we try to provide for future works and making them persist. And I would submit that those are completely different problems, that the answers, the solutions to handling works that were created in previous or our current environment is one type of problem. But what we can do or what we can prepare for several years from now and well into the future is a very different kind of problem. So for going backwards, retrospectively, and the PADS committee has discussed some of this, this I should make disclaimer here. These are my ideas, and not this does not necessarily represent the thinking of PAD on these. One of the things we did discuss extensively in PAD was to try to kind of categorize the types of electronic literature into different types, and to try to what the solution for handling each of those different types might be different, or it might diverge somewhat. So we looked at text or Lexia-based hypertext and interactive works, the StorySpace ones, hypertext that are in plain HTML, hypertext and interactive works that have more complexity, like DHTML, layers, JavaScript, cascading style sheets, Flash, Director and Shockwave, interactive fiction and drama, and algorithmically generated works. And if you think about it, at least on a lower level, what you have to do with each of those would be different. At a higher level, they might be the same. So one suggestion on how to proceed that I would make is that we take some works in each of those types and attempt various preservation or restoration methods. For instance, having an archival repository that saves the bits, that also saves the kind of ancillary material that I think is important in in trying to make these things persist. Things like the maps and storyboards that were used to create it, as well as saving some of the software itself, like the actual story space code, which of course you start getting into copyright issues with that as well. And just saving all these things, hoping that we can make some future breakthroughs in ways to restore them. To write open source code to construct viewers that will read these older works on today's machines. And to make that open source because then as the environments change, people can mess with that code and make the changes that are necessary. If we start writing them in things that aren't open source, they may work fine today, but how's someone gonna rewrite them 5 years from now or 10 years from now? And to also, at the same time as a fail-safe method, also save supporting material, things like the shots of the screen. Because if we can't resurrect the work, at the very least, we want to be able to tell people 50 years from now what these works look like. So to have screenshots, videos of someone interacting with it, interviews with the author, designer, interviews with users right after they've used it for a session, things like that are important. If we can't save the work itself, that's still very important material in terms of kind of a fail-safe, saving a record of what this period of time was like. And then to examine the results and review how usable each of these things was under each kind of method after 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, things like that. And then at the same time, to also, as part of this, to assess the cost, the time, and the skills that were involved in each of those. And to try to see how difficult was this problem and what are some of the trade-offs in these different ways of saving these things. And probably the things that are most robust and save the thing, the work in the most useful way are probably the most expensive, I would guess. So that's looking backwards. Looking forwards, and again, this is my variant on the things that Pad has been discussing, so this is not the necessarily the views of the group. To start developing standards for encoding things like interactive behaviors, timing, to develop the kind of metadata standards we need to go beyond what other communities have done, to build on what other communities have done, but extend them to what is necessary for this community. And then to start gaining work towards gaining community consensus from among electronic literature creators for supporting these standards. To start expressing these standards in ways as extensions for other community standards. Merrily Prophet's going to be talking about the metadata encoding and transmission standard, METS, this afternoon, and the possibility of grafting these, I'm suggesting the possibility of grafting these kind of things that we need for this community onto existing standards like that. To either convince vendors of authoring software to export the software to these standards so that if you created something in StorySpace or if you created something in Director, if they would give us the ability to export into this kind of new standard or extended standard that we develop, or else to design our own open source authoring software that or set of software that would allow us to put things in these kind of standard metadata encoded schemes. To partner with a stable institution that's running a digital preservation repository and to use the encoded standards that we develop as directions of how to handle these works over time. to develop model copyright rights contracts that allow ELO to distribute a work if it's no longer in distribution elsewhere. So again, this is like working with some of the things that Jamie suggested, like the Creative Commons, to work up contracts where if a work is not in distribution, if no one is distributing it, that ELO have the ability to distribute it so that it just doesn't go fallow. And convince the community of authors to place copies of their works into this in what we call dark archives that have no access but have management to them. And so that as long as they're in print and an author sees that they're realizing some kind of return on it, there's still a copy, a fail-safe copy in these dark archives. But as soon as it's out of press, not available, then it sees the light of day and it's no longer a dark archive. And then finally, that we collaborate with other initiatives, and I'll be talking about these this afternoon in Jeff's session. Initiatives like the Library of Congress's National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Project, with which Stuart Brand will be talking about. Inter Pares Project, which the archival community is developing for handling interactive types of works, and the Variable Media Initiative that the digital art community is developing. So here's just some URLs. The first is an article that I've written about digital repositories. The second is a website that I have, that I maintain on digital preservation. The third is an article that I've written on preserving electronic art. And then there's various others there. And so, Alan?